We are talking today, the theme of the lecture today is peace or conflict resolution, which have been a topic that has been studied one of the most exciting or important topics, which is because of the importance of conflict resolution, importance of peacemaking, importance of negotiation between conflicting parties. And this topic has been and is being studied in a large number of universities around the world because of its importance. And we have also here the Haifa University international program in conflict resolution headed by Professor Miller, who is currently in Princeton, United States, and he apologized for not being able to come. If we are talking about peace building or peace program, I think there is no better person to present it and also to bring novel ideas, both from his own personal religious beliefs as well as his personal practice or what he has been developed personally, and the program is being implemented around many countries around the world. We are very delighted to have as our guest Dr. Hossein Danesh, who is the founder and president of the International Education for Peace Institute in Canada and Switzerland, a visiting faculty at the European Peace University in Austria, Transcend Peace University, Germany, and the former president of Lande International University in Switzerland. He's a retired professor of conflict resolution and peace education and psychiatry. His areas of research and expertise include peace studies, education for peace, leadership for peace, religion and peace, causes and prevention of violence, marriage and family therapy, unity-based conflict resolution, and psychology of spirituality. Dr. Danesh is the author and creator of the internationally acclaimed Education for Peace program, first piloted in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and the main author of its multi-volume curriculum. And the topic of your lecture today is Reflections on the Baha'i Peace Program. So, please.
Thank you. But I think I would stand up to see everybody. Good morning. Thank you very much, Soli.
Thank you very much.
I met Soli many years ago in Switzerland, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to share with you some thoughts about the Baha'i Peace Program. And I think it is very interesting that this talk is taking place in this city and at this university, because, first of all, Israel is the focal place of four major revealed religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Baha'i faith, and the international and holy places of these religions are here in this country, and the International Baha'i Center and the holy shrines of the Baha'i faith are in Haifa and surrounding area. So this is a very apt place to talk about the Baha'i Peace Program, and also because Soli has started a series, lecture series on the Baha'i faith, and he is a scholar of many areas of Baha'i history, and his publications are admirable in that respect. So I am delighted and honored to be here. And also, I'm honored to be here because the whole area of peace studies in general and peace education in particular, although has been happening around the world, as has one of its main areas of scientific study and research, this country. Outstanding scholars in this country have contributed to the study of peace in general and peace education in particular. At this university, you have a Professor Gaby Solomon, who is now retired, outstanding, world-renowned scholar in this area. So I'm honored and delighted to be here. I know how you all are seeking peace, and we all are. My professional life had two components, or two eras. The first phase was in psychiatry, and I practiced psychiatry for 30 years. And then the second phase, which is now in its 20th year, you see I'm old, in 20th year, has been focused on peace studies, peace education. And this has been a continuation from psychiatry into peace education. A continuation of psychiatry to peace was a natural process for me, because when I was practicing psychiatry, individuals, married couples, families, schools, communities would come to me. When really looked at the core of what they were looking for was peace. People would go to psychiatry, to psychiatrists, and say, give me peace. Give me peace of mind, give me peaceful relationships, let me create a peaceful environment, a peaceful school. Peace has been always the quest of humanity. It's nothing unusual, least to me. So, my own practice, on the one hand, the fact that I was born and raised in Iran, a country of enormous violence, a country that doesn't know peace, and being a member of the minority in that country, member of the Baha'i faith, and being persecuted throughout the years that I was there. These all contributed to my interest in the area of peace. And then I went, after finishing medical school in Iran, went to United States and specialized in psychiatry. And United States, a country of individualism and excessive liberalism with enormous interest in conflict and violence and prevalence of violence. These all make you reflect on what is peace? How can we create peace? How we can go about peace? So I was challenged in my studies, because if you look into literature about peace, you would see that fundamentally it is believed at this time that conflict is an innate and unavoidable aspect of human experience. And therefore, we always are going to have conflict. And if we don't know what to do with it, conflict is going to deteriorate into violence. And neither conflict nor violence are conducive to peace. So as such, if we follow that way of thinking, we just simply have to give up the idea that we are going to have peace. That peace is not possible. On the other hand, I was very interested in the teachings of the Baha'i faith. And when you review the Baha'i literature, holy writings of the Baha'i faith, you will see that the notion of conflict between human beings, between religions, between nations, is totally rejected. And the fundamental focus of the Baha'i faith is peace. I'll give you an example of it. So you see how this it has evolved in the Baha'i thinking about peace and the origins of it, you see. In the spring of 1890, Edward Granville Brown, who was a professor at Cambridge University, an Orientalist, who had been in Iran, who had been very familiar with the, both the Babi and the Baha'i religions, and who spoke Persian and so forth. He came to Akko, where Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith, was a prisoner. And he was the only Westerner that had the opportunity to meet Baha'u'llah.
To meet
Baha'u'llah. The only Westerner. And here is what happened in that meeting, that historic meeting. This is the account of Brown. Brown says, "The face of him on whom I gazed, I can never forget, though I cannot describe it. Those piercing eyes seem to read one's very soul. Power and authority sat on that ample brow. No need to ask in whose presence I stood. As I bowed myself before one who is the object of a devotion and love, which kings might envy, an emperor's sign for in vain. A mild and dignified voice bade me to be seated and then continued." This is what Baha'u'llah said in that interview with Brown. His message to the Western world, basically, and all world, okay. He said, "Praise be God, to be God, that thou hast attained. Thou hast come to see a prisoner and an exile. We desire but the good of the world and the happiness of the nations, that all nations should become one in faith and all men as brothers, that the bonds of affection and unity between the sons of men should be strengthened, that diversity of religion should cease and differences of race be annulled. What harm is there in this? Yet, so it shall be. These fruitless strifes, these ruinous wars shall pass away, and the most great peace shall come. Let not a man glory in this, that he loves his country. Let him rather glory in this, that he loves his kind." Now that was in 1890, in this area. This call for peace was. When we study the writings of the Baha'i faith, we realize that there are at least two dimensions about the Baha'i peace programs, two issues. One is the Baha'i concept of peace, and the other one is the Baha'i community as a prototype of a peaceful society. In my talk, I will primarily will focus on the Baha'i concept of peace. It would take much longer if I was to focus on the second item as well. Now, the Baha'i concept of peace is it has certain unique characteristics, and it is it focuses on the one hand on the moral and the spiritual aspects of peace, foundations of peace. It focuses on the main prerequisite for social peace, how you can create social peace, and it offers the necessary social and political structure of how to create a worldwide peace. It focuses on all three of them. With regard to the spiritual dimension, when you study the Baha'i writings, you will see that it says that the fundamental reason for creation of human beings is that we become promoters and creators of peace. That this is our ultimate objective in life. Not only that is ultimate objective of every individual, but it is also the ultimate objective of every religion, that it should be the promoter of peace. That if religion doesn't create peace, it is not acceptable, and it's better to be without a religion. So this is the core of the teachings of the Baha'i faith. Now, how these evolve, you know, what are the conceptual foundations that we can find with respect to issue of peace from a Baha'i perspective? And what I'm going to share with you is my personal view, of course. It's not a formal Baha'i presentation. Second, it is a combination of my studies of the Baha'i faith, my studies in psychology of peace, my studies in the social phenomena that I have experienced living in
Iran,
in United States, in Europe, and having traveled to over 70 countries around the world, communicating with colleagues and collaborators all over the world. And what I'm sharing with you is the outcome of these processes, and should be seen as such. There are three concepts that I want to share with you as being essential for our understanding of the concept of peace. Okay. The first concept is the concept of unity. Unity is the primary law of existence. Everything that exists is the outcome of law of unity. For example, this table here, we know that this table is made up of enormous amount of empty space, right? There are molecules and atoms and subatomic particles. All of them are working towards together in through the force of unity. And as long as that unity of these components are there, this table is going to be okay. Right? This building is standing up through the operation of law of unity. Our bodies right now is functioning through the operation of law of unity. Just think about us as human beings. Where we come from? We come from the unification of the sperm and ovum in the wombs of our mothers. If the sperm and ovum have become united, we wouldn't be here. And it is through that process that then we have come to this life, who we are. And right now we are operating here because there is a fundamental unity between all components of our body. Think of your organs of your body. Think if for a moment your heart and your brain begin to fight with each other. And your heart says, you know, you want me to show you who is the stronger? You want me to stop sending blood? And the brain says, you want me to stop this sending the signals, the electrical signals? And the lung said, I'm going to quit, I'm tired. And you don't breathe. Just imagine what would happen. The reason that we are in this state is because we are functioning according to the law of unity. And law of unity is the cause of life. And it always is expressed in the context of diversity. It is impossible to have unity without diversity. Unity without diversity is uniformity. So, and diversity without unity is chaos and conflict. So the fundamental law of life, the fundamental law of existence is unity. And this law applies to the physical level, biological level, social level, unity of the family, unity of the society, unity of nations, unity of the world. These are the laws that govern. And whenever we violate the law of unity, we have conflict. So from this perspective, conflict is not an innate quality of human being. Conflict is absence of unity. Conflict is absence of unity. And conflict resolution is the process of learning how to create unity. The reason that our approaches to conflict resolution don't work is because we try to resolve a disease without treating it. You see, conflict is like a disease. If you want to treat a disease, you have to go to see what caused the disease. What is causing the disease in the world of humanity, the disease of conflict, is because of disunity, because absence of unity. If you want to create unity, if you want to remove conflict, you have to create unity. There is no other way. And therefore, we have to make a fundamental change in our way of thinking about conflict. Let me give you an example of current conflict. For example, Galtung, Johan Galtung. You all have heard about Johan Galtung. Johan Galtung is considered as being the father of modern studies of peace, okay? Very good friend of mine, okay? And we argue a lot, okay? And he said, conflict, incompatible goals are as human as life itself. Listen, conflict, incompatible goals are as human as life itself. The only conflict-free humans are dead humans. Isn't that interesting? That's the way of thinking in the conflict resolution community. That the only way that we are alive is through conflict. And if we become conflict-free, which means peaceful, we have to die. Okay? And he further goes, The only conflict-free humans are dead humans, and war and violence are like slavery, colonialism, and patriarchy. They come and they go. You see how negative is this view of human reality, that we are not going to be able to get rid of conflict or violence or war or colonialism or patriarchy or slavery, that these are going to be with humanity, they come and they go. Okay. And this, of course, this concept is related to the concept of survival of the fittest that is being promoted not only in biology but also in political sciences, in economics, in all of those things. The whole area, you see. So we live in a world that is imbued with conflict. Our way of thinking, our view of this world, our view of the life, our life, is all mixed with conflict. Our students, our children, think of our children and what they experience with violence. Our children are born into families that often are conflicted. Often husbands and wives don't have good relationships. Often there are difficulties in families and the parents don't know how to handle them. What they do, parents, they say, watch TV. And what they watch on TV, they watch conflict and violence. They go to school, and what they experience, conflict and violence and bullying. They study. What they study, what is history? History is about generals and kings and emperors who went and killed each other, right? What is not present in history books? There are two things not present. So peace is not present, and women are not present. Women. Yeah, women didn't exist. You look history books. Do they talk about any women? No. They talk about men. What kind of men? Fighting men. Juvenile men. Who go to war. That's what history books. And our children read history. Geography. What they learn about geography? This part of the world, that part of the world, we divided here, we divided there. What they read about in sociology, in group and out groups, us and them, good people and bad people. What they, everything that they study, capitalism, survival of the fittest, political science, multi-party adversarial democracy, the highest achievement of humanity so far. Just think about it. So it's no wonder that every generation grows up to be more and more comfortable with conflict and less aware of peace, not knowing what peace is, not even thinking about dynamics of peace. We don't have literature on peace. When people talk about peace studies, if you look at the curriculum of universities that offer peace studies program, you see that all about conflict studies. They don't talk about phenomena of peace. They talk about phenomena of conflict and what to do with conflict.
Without conflict, we don't have peace. You must have conflict to make peace.
No, you have to have peace in order not to have conflict.
Yeah, but
my
conflict.
Yeah, I know that, what you mean. Okay. So, this is the worldview that we have. What is the second concept? The first concept was concept of unity that I briefly described. The second concept is the concept of worldview. Every human being functions within the framework of his or her world view. Every society functions within the framework of its world view. A world view has four components. our view of reality, our view of human nature, our view of the purpose of life, and our view of laws of human relationships. Everybody has a worldview. And our worldview has these four components: what we think about reality, what we think about human nature, what we think about the purpose of life, and what we think about human relationships. Now, worldviews develop in a subconscious, unconscious manner. They develop through our daily experiences, our life experiences, the education we receive, the ideologies that we have. The whole process of life makes us to develop our worldview. And our worldview is not conscious to us. Not until this moment that I was talking with you, I don't think you were thinking about your worldview. What is my worldview? Okay. And people usually don't ask themselves, what is my view of reality? But if we reflect closely, we see that most people have a dichotomous view of reality. The dichotomous view of reality means that most people think in dualism. Us and them. Good and bad. Men and women. This group and that group. Okay? Science and religion. We separate things from each other. We have this notion, a dualistic notion of reality. While in reality, reality is one. Okay? We have to learn how to look at the whole phenomenon of universe and life through a lens of unity. And because we haven't learned to look at life through lens of unity, we see everything in dichotomy. Now, dichotomy creates conflict. And the most profound expression of dichotomy is in our view of human nature. Because people usually believe that there are good people in this world and bad people. And we are the good people and we are the bad people. In this, because we have this subconscious, unconscious, dichotomous thinking of reality, we translate that dichotomous thinking of reality into our understanding of the human nature, and therefore we conclude that human nature is negative and is conflicted. And people are some good and some bad. And then that shapes our view of the purpose of life. If you live in a dichotomous world which is conflicted, and which is populated by good people and bad people, what do? You have to protect yourself and your loved ones from bad people. And you have to have power to control bad people. And then what we have? We have the world that we have today. Everywhere in the world, everywhere you go, this phenomenon is operating. Which then all of them shape our relationships, human relationships. Our human relationship becomes conflict-based. And it is, you see, the power of worldview is profound. Okay. Now, worldviews, we can have many, many worldviews, but if we want to really think about worldviews in a systematic manner, we can identify three meta categories of worldview. Okay? The first and the most common worldview I call, this is the category that I have done, okay? I call it survival-based worldview. Survival-based worldview is the most common worldview, the most ancient worldview. As humanity was evolving on this planet, life was dangerous. The most important thing about life was to survive. Where the next food would come from, where you can find a shelter, where how you can protect yourself from the forces that are outside you, be it animals, be it nature, be it other human beings, and so forth. So survival-based worldview has been the most common worldview in human history. And in survival-based worldview, people seek power in order to control others and control the dangers that comes to them. So survival-based worldview becomes a power-based worldview. And the power is used as force. It's a force-based worldview. And in the force-based worldview, you have to have people who have power and people who are powerless. Or you have less power, so you can control them. You see? And this becomes the mode of operation in human society. For example, the most common example of survival-based worldview has been relationship between men and women. Men, because they had physical power, they decided they are going to control women. They have done a good job so far. But now, I'm sorry to say to our men here, you're losing. Okay.
Women
now have more power. Okay. But dangerous times coming, dear friends. Okay. So, but the whole inequality of men and women, the gender inequality is an expression of a survival-based, authoritarian-based worldview. Authoritarian forms of government is an expression of survival-based worldview. That few people take control and bring power and force in their hands and control masses of humanity. Okay, this we have seen it throughout history. Yeah, you know, and so forth. So the most common and the most pervasive worldview in human history has always been survival-based worldview, and still, to a very large degree, is a survival-based worldview. However, since the beginning of the modern era, 2-3 centuries ago, since then, the process began to change. Humanity collectively entered a new phase, and a new type of worldview emerged. You see, this is related to the third concept that I wanted to talk about. I said I'd share with you three concepts, you see. One was concept of unity, the other concept of worldview, and now the third concept is the concept of development. And that is both individual development and societal, collective development, you see. Development takes place on the axis of consciousness. What develops is human consciousness. Matter doesn't develop. Matter becomes more complicated and more complex. It is what develops is human consciousness. Okay. And therefore we are in that, we are, humanity's consciousness has been evolving. And that consciousness began to evolve in a more dramatic manner about 200-300 years ago. And we began to have a new era in human history, which is correspondent with the collective adolescence of humanity. Our world now is moving away from the authoritarian, power-based, survival-based, to the next era of our collective development, which I call identity-based worldview. Identity-based worldview, which corresponds to the individual adolescence, is in a world in which the power is shared. Okay? It's like a jungle. In a jungle, all animals, they have different kinds of power. Mm-hmm. You know, even the little mouse can go on the back of the elephant and start eating on the back of the elephant. An elephant cannot do anything about it. Okay? This is the nature and dynamics of power. So the most important thing in this identity-based worldview is competition. We compete. Who is going to win? The whole idea is to win. While in the survival-based worldview, the idea is who is going to control. In the identity-based worldview, which was the era of Darwin, the survival of fittest describes the reality of existence. And we are now in that phase in the collective development of humanity. Our world at the level of consciousness is functioning according to level of adolescence. And that's why competition is so prevalent in our way of thinking. Power struggle is so prevalent. Let me give you examples of the identity-based worldview in the world today, okay? The whole movement of equality of women and men is that one expression of that. The whole movement for creating nations based on historical identities of people. Israel is a good example of it. Mm-hmm. Okay? All over the world. It is for a group of people to say, to establish their identity as unique beings in this panorama of humanity. Okay? We are in the midst of that formation of identities, not because of colonialism, not because of control of others, but because people have rightful access to establish their unique cultural entities and identities, to have unique identities. And if this is the phase that we are in, that's the reason that in Canada, for example, you know, the French part of Canada, they want to separate. Okay? So, you know, Canada is a good country, it's a peaceful country, but people say, no, we want to be independent. You see, this is the time of moving towards that process. Okay? This is the time. And this is understandable. We live in that era, in that phase. We are in the phase of our collective adolescence. Our music is adolescence, our blue jeans are adolescence, our way of life is adolescence, our political functions, parties going against each other, leaders going against each other, who is more handsome on the television, who won this argument, who did that. Everything in the world, its economy is all in competition state. The whole world is now is functioning according to this level of consciousness. However, I said there are three major categories of worldview. The first category, survival-based. The second category, identity-based. The third category, which humanity now is approaching, is the unity-based worldview. This is the era that humanity is beginning to understand that we have to move from earlier stages of our collective development and individual development, from the era of authoritarian power-based, survival-based, the era of identity-based, competitive-based, and so forth, to era of unity and peace. You know, think of Europe. European nations had to go through two world wars, kill millions and millions and millions of people, bring enormous destruction to humanity because they were little adolescent nations at each other's. And finally said, oh, let's give up. Let's start, you know, creating a European Union and so forth. They still hate each other. But they realize that through the experience that they have done, that they have to go differently. The establishment of United Nations, the League of Nations, all of these economic agreements that we are doing around the world, all of these movements around the world are movements towards unity. The world of humanity is moving towards unity, whether we like it or we don't like it, which takes us to the issue of worldview transformation. You see, worldviews, identity-based, survival-based, unity-based, and every one of us here can think about which kind of a worldview is we have, and which kind of worldview in our society is prevalent, and so forth. You know it. Okay. The worldviews have to change. They have to transform. And there are two ways that the worldviews are transformed. One is like the old stories of good news and bad news, okay? One is that the worldviews can transform either through crisis or through new insights. Crisis is the most common way of change of worldview. People don't change their worldview until they have to change their worldview, you know? Until they hit the bottom, until they become absolutely desperate, until they don't have any other way out, and then say, I think I have to change my book. I have to think differently. I have to approach things differently. This was what happened in Europe. This is United States is the midst of its adolescent behavior right now. Everybody has guns and everybody is doing whatever they're doing and so forth. They have to go until they really, really, really become desperate. Unfortunately, that's the way the world is functioning. Okay? The world functioning. But there is another way of the world change of transformation of worldview. And that is when we become aware of our worldview. We become aware that there are different kinds of worldview. We become aware that there is a unity-based kind of worldview, a peace-based kind of worldview, and that we can move towards that. And we can consciously, deliberately begin to change that. We see elements of that in movements such as some components of United Nations, such World Health Organizations, the environmental movement, the gender equality movement, the human rights movement. These are movements that are calling for transformation in worldviews, that we have to transform our worldviews, our way of thinking, our consciousness to move to the next level. And only it is through that process that we create peace. Okay? Now, few more, and then I have to stop, I guess, right? 5 minutes. not bad. I thought that I'm getting that flavor. Okay, so when we study the writings of the Baha'i Faith, we see that in different writings, the fundamental requisites or prerequisites of peace are outlined. For example, there are statements by Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha in which he says, the peace of the world would not be established until its unity is established. So, peace is the ultimate objective. If we want to have peace, we have to have unity. However, unity cannot be established unless its prerequisite is present. And in his tablet to the world, Baha'u'llah says, the purpose of justice is appearance of unity among people. If we want to have unity, we have to have a just society. We have to have justice. We cannot have unity without justice.
Who is justice?
Justice is that phenomena in which we work together to create unity.
Who make the rules?
Yeah, the unity. There's of course there are two dimensions to issue of justice. One is reward and punishment. The other one is the purpose of reward and punishment. That the purpose is to create conditions that is are conducive to justice, to unity. And when we do that, we have brought about justice. That now, because our mindset, our worldview, is an identity-based worldview, a dichotomous worldview, us and them worldview, then it becomes my justice and your justice and his justice and everybody else's justice. But when we move from that worldview to the unity-based worldview, then it becomes clear that there is a pervasive, all-encompassing process that we can create to bring justice, to historical justice as well as the immediate justice to the masses of humanity. But that requires a change of worldview. We wouldn't be able to do it. So, to have peace, we need unity. To have unity, we need justice. To have justice, what is the main prerequisite for justice? The main prerequisite for justice is equality. Mm-hmm. Equality.
Yes.
Particularly, gender equality. Equality between men and women. Abdul Baha, the center of the covenant of the Baha'i Faith, says that the peace of world is impossible until women are on an equal basis with men in not only opportunities but in administration of human affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Administration of human governance of this world. Okay. And then what is the main prerequisite for equality? Main prerequisite for equality is universality. In other words, we have to begin our consciousness and thinking, bring our consciousness and thinking in harmony with fundamental reality of existence. And that fundamental reality is consciousness of the oneness of humanity. This is the central theme of the Baha'i Faith, that humanity always has been one, okay? There's one race of humanity, but we haven't been conscious of it. We haven't been conscious of it because we have looked at humanity through the eyes of otherness, rather than through the prism of unity. And therefore, we think there are many humanities, but there is only one humanity. So there is much more to go, but this is the summary of the Bahasam concepts of the Baha'i Faith with regard to peace. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Danesh, for giving us the privilege of getting to know a different, totally different worldview, concept of how to make peace. And I advise you maybe to consider, we know there is an Israeli-Palestinian thing going on.
Yeah, I have some idea.
I'm sure they need an extra hand.
Both leader to psychiatric view.
And I would propose whether you have considered presenting this in TED, this concept. It's a good idea, so this is a medium that you can, you know.
I don't know how to go about that.
Well, you can apply to TED. And,
all right.
So that's a good view. I think that's a good view. Yes, the floor is open for questions. Yes, please.
Well, thank you very much for
You're
the
welcome.
Lecture. It's really a pleasure to hear about Baha'i faith. This is my first time, at least. That I hear such a really rich explanation. As a part of a minority in the same point of view, but maybe a little bit bigger, I am a part of the Arab minority inside Israel, and as a human rights activist. I would like to ask you, I'm trying with through my course to write or to prove that after Oslo, the minority Arabs, the Arab minority inside Israel, they started to develop their identity, unique identity, and their collective rights in the state. Because in Oslo we were out of the process, and what it's not clear for me is the issue of universality.
Yes.
I believe in justice. I work in an organization called Justice. We work for justice, but still something missing, which not clear for
yes.
me.
Yes. You see, within the framework of a unity-based worldview, several things happens. First of all, when we are in a state of unity, our survival becomes much more secure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? A unified society has much greater degree of capacity to take care of its members and so forth.
This if the state is not a Jewish state.
No. I'm not talking about Jewish and Palestinian. I'm talking about general. Okay. Because I'm inviting you to do something unusual here.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, of course. So
my challenge.
That's right. So between from in the context of unity,
mm-hmm.
both your survival and your identity are secure.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a unity-based worldview means a worldview, a way of organization of human societies in which the welfare of all people are considered,
mm-hmm.
and protected, and their unique identities are acknowledged, valued, and promoted.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the whole concept of unity is the whole issue of diversity,
mm-hmm.
in which diverse people come together and create a larger whole,
mm-hmm.
without losing their identity,
mm-hmm.
with their unique identity.
Mm-hmm.
So from perspective of a unity-based worldview, Israelis and Arabs and everybody else, they all have unique identities, unique cultures, unique contributions to make to the world of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
We are all at once unique and universal.
Mm-hmm.
We are all at once citizens of Israel and citizens of Palestine and citizens of wherever,
mm-hmm.
and we are also citizens of one world.
Mm-hmm.
When we move towards unity, our identities, our personal identities, they are not obliterated, they are not taken away from us. We become unique in the context of the universal, you see. And that's a good example of it, is, you know, in the context of, let's say, European Union.
Mm-hmm.
The countries have remained, but they have developed a higher the level of identity also, okay? That's what has to happen in African, you know, now we have African Union and all of these. The idea is to expand without losing the uniqueness. This is the combination of uniqueness and universality. And this is the requirement of a more mature way of consciousness, a more mature, more evolved consciousness, which, as I said, is upon us. We don't have really a choice but to move towards that expanded consciousness and awareness of humanity. We don't have a choice. We are moving that. But as I said, unfortunately, the process of change of worldview has been always through trials and through fire,
mm-hmm.
rather than through consciousness and awareness. What a true religion does, a true religion is the process of peaceful change of worldview. You see, I come from a Muslim family.
From?
Muslim family.
Yes.
But when I became a Baha'i, my whole worldview changed.
Mm-hmm.
Then Muslims were my friends, and Jews my friends, and mm-hmm. Christians were my friends, and everybody was my friend, and that was it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I suddenly became universal.
I
became universal. I didn't lose my identity. But my identity
Which
expanded.
Is your identity? If you want to specify your identity.
I'm a citizen of the world.
Citizen.
Okay. Yes.
No, you said
no.
That I didn't lose my identity.
No.
Because I became
I am a person with expanded identity.
Okay, that's it.
You see? With an expanded identity. And still I have some habits that are Persians. My wife is my wife Michelle Bernstein, okay? You know, Jewish. Who is a Baha'i, okay, from United States. She has, you know, and I became, you know, and our children, they were born by a father, came from Iran, and Muslim Baha'i, a mother from United States, Jewish Baha'i. They develop a universal identity, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't lose yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You become bigger. You expand your universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you have your son circumcised?
Yes, they were both circumcised. I'm a medical doctor also. I realized that was helpful. You know. that's healthy also. So yes, they did.
Yes. Other questions?
Go ahead.
Yes, Sasha.
I just had a small remark. Thank you very much for the presentation. I really enjoyed it very much. And what came to my mind, and I just wanted to share with you along the lines you were talking about identities and conflict. You know, one of the, I think, most influential books in the last 20, 30 years in political science is the Clash of Civilizations by Huntington.
Of course, yeah.
In the introduction to this book, what is very interesting, and I never forgot that, he says, we know who we are if we know who we are not against whom we are.
That's right.
And he complained at that time, in the beginning of the 90s, that leading academics thought that the main conflict was democratic world and the communistic world. Now that is gone. And now they think peace can come, but he complains and he says we have new identities.
That's right.
Built on religion and culture. And we need this fight. And it's sad, but we need
That's
kind
right.
of an enemy. And you can see this almost everywhere in literature and political science, you know, that this need of enemy building is...
Yeah, but that's the characteristic of a second level and first level of consciousness, the worldview. These are the scientific expressions of survival-based worldview and identity-based worldview. And that's the reason that I completely challenge the current perspectives on conflict and so what it is. It's just not, as far as I'm concerned, they don't hold any water any longer.
Yes, they do.
Just a small thing that came on my mind. I'm dealing with my research with the issue of higher education and its role in shaping political identities. Now, in this frame, I would like to raise the point that right now we are sitting in the Faculty of Humanity, or under the auspice of the Faculty of Humanity, not the Faculty of the Faculty of Humanities, and not the Faculty of Humanity.
Yes.
So if we're talking about political discourse and how they shape the mind.
Yeah, universities are the most identity-based adolescent environments you want. They are absolutely identity-based. Competition that is going on, and the lack of openness to new ideas and so forth. It's I've been, all my life has been in university. I know how it is, you know. And, you know, this is the challenge of our times, yes. Researchers, scholars have to become aware of their worldview and the impact of their worldview on the research that they do and the conclusions that they reach. You know,
yes.
My most recent book just came out last week, is called Fever in the World of the Mind. And the subtitle is On Causes and Fever in the World of the Mind. And the subtitle is On Causes and Prevention of Violence. And in it, I talk about the impact of mindset and of people on this issue. So anyway, that's a long story.
Congratulations for the new book.
Yeah. By the way, if you want to look at my books, some of my books, most of them are, the best way to go and find them is on Amazon. If you go H.B. Donish, under books, you will find many volumes of Education for Peace, Integrative Curriculum Series. You have one copy of it.
Yes.
And many of them. So you will see many of the books, and including this new book.
I just wanted to mention, excuse me, John, that relating to what you said, of course, Dr. Danesh didn't have the time to expound on all the aspects of the Baha'i religion, but there is also, the conflict that we have here in this area. As much of it is religious based. And of course, the Baha'i worldview is also have the unity of religions and the progressive revelation. Maybe you want to expand a little bit on that. The unity dimension, it goes also into the the religions.
That's
so
right.
It's very
Unity of religion, meaning that there is only one religion. There is only one religion of God. There is one God, and there is one religion of God. And because humanity evolves, the religion of God is renewed according to the needs of humanity at different stages in its evolution. So religion comes from time to time to time. And if you look at them, you will see that every new religion that comes, they take focus on the essence of the previous teachings of previous religion and say, yeah, they are all correct. And they bring new dimensions according to the needs of humanity at that time. So you look at the Old Testament, the New Testament, Quran, you will see, you know, you go to Quran, and they tell the stories of the Old Testament and New Testament and all of those teachings, because those are from God. This is, God hasn't changed, you know. We are changing. We as humanity evolve and develop. And Baha'u'llah, when you read in the writings of Baha'u'llah, you will see the profound respect and acceptance and of all religions of the world, and seeing the fundamental oneness of the spiritual principles of all religions, that they are constantly expanded and given to humanity at a higher level of the through a new revelation, in order to help humanity to move beyond, to go further and further and further. So the concept of unity in the Baha'i faith is there is one God, there is one religion of the God, and therefore all religions have the opportunity to unite. And there is one humanity, and therefore all masses of humanity can unite with each other. This is a comprehensive concept in the book that I gave you, my book, one of my books. I go into that detail, in details about that, and I included in that a talk that I gave at the Hebrew University of in Jerusalem on the whole issue of Baha'i perspective on religion and how Baha'i perspective in religion focuses on our fundamental unity. You know.
Yes, John.
You talked of dichotomy.
Yes, I did.
Men, women, science, religion.
I said this is the way people
right.
are. Yeah.
I think a useful way to join the two sides is instead of saying the little word or in the middle, you put the little word and in the middle.
Yeah, of course.
Both
that's
and rather than
well, this
either
is,
or.
This is the whole unity.
And we think so much
yeah.
or rather than and. We're tuned to thinking
that's very
old,
true.
Old style.
That's very true.
With or.
As soon as we begin to focus on all phenomena of life through the lens of unity, as soon as we begin to do that, then the ors change to and, you know.
And a second question, please. Your personal view. When do you think there will be gender equality in the Universal House of Justice?
Gender equality?
Yeah, i.e. women in the Universal House of Justice.
Well, I don't think at this time it's going to happen.
This time?
No.
But next time?
Because it's, again, you see, the is the revelation of God is an ongoing revelation. This is not the last religion coming from God. That, you know, Baha'u'llah clearly says he has come and others will come after him and religion will be renewed according to the conditions of time. The challenge for men in our world today is to learn the ways of equality. This is the challenge. And it is men's responsibility to bring equality, gender equality, not women's responsibility to fight for it. Right now, women have to fight for equality. The fundamental challenge is for men, and including men of the House of Justice, is to create conditions in the world of humanity. And within the Baha'i community and outside of the Baha'i community, so that women, men would learn to deal on an equal basis with women, rather than women being so desperate fighting for their rights, equal rights. It is our challenge. This is the process of men moving from juvenile, adolescent way of power-based thinking to become much more feminine qualities, much more aware, that becoming whole people. And in the process, women, through the education that receive, through the equal rights that they have and so forth, begin to show their unique capacities to advance civilization. So this is the focus of the Universal House of Justice. And if we had the chance to look at the Baha'i community and how it works, you will see how it's really beautifully working. So that's not an issue. The fundamental issue is not who is on the House of Justice. The fundamental issue is what is House of Justice doing to bring about the fundamental harmony and equality between men and women, between races of humanity, between unity. All of those. That's unity. That's the fundamental. We get stuck on these notions of this and that, which is belongs to a adolescent-based, identity-based worldview rather than unity-based worldview. Once we begin to look at the unity-based worldview, these issues go into background. Fundamental issues come to the forefront.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Danesh, for
inviting
us again. And we have reserved the next time you come here, definitely
thank
you. To expand more. As you can see, there is interest.